You knew about Gersalin and Alton Bronner. I'm going to give you five other names.
Continue.
Cassandra Lang, Eduard Gresnik, Della de Marinus, Simon Marego, Terzet Friller. Dreyfus paused and took a sip of paper from his uniform, passing it to Seraphim. Seraphim looked doubtfully at the list.
They're just names, Dreyfus.
All I want from you is categoric assurance that none of these people are, or were, the subjects of any particular vendettas or grudges known to you or your ultra-associates.
Then these people, one may presume, are now dead?
Very, Dreyfus said.
I guarantee the safety of the ships and crews inside the parking swarm.
Seraphim answered, I am not responsible for the individual actions of those crows. Beneath him the chair hummed and gurgled as hidden pumps pushed fluid around. But I will make inquiries.
If actions have happened, actions that violate our own system of ethics.
You have ethics now.
I wouldn't take such a combative tone, not when you come begging favours.
Seraphim cocked his head, studying him from a slightly different angle.
You seem a very troubled man. More than usual, if that was possible.
It comes with the times, Dreyfus said. While Spava prepared the suits, Talia used the Corvette's communication suite to call back to the Shigamint spindle. The heavy medical squad had left the Bronner residence when they brought Grobno and the widow back to Panoply, but a small forensic team was still on site, completing a thorough sweep of the house.
"Prefect Boniface," she said, recognizing the face on the display. "This is Eng. I was at the Bronner residence before the medicals came in. I have a slightly unusual request."
Boniface was indoors, gowned technicians working behind her.
"How may I help, Prefect Eng?"
"Slip your goggles on, then send the feed through to me. I'd like you to go through to the first or second room from the front of the dwelling, assuming nothing has been disturbed since I was inside. There's something I'd like to show my deputy."
"Just a moment."
Boniface took out her goggles, fiddled with a setting, then pushed them over her eyes. After a second, the scene switched to Boniface's point of view.
"Are you getting this, Prefect Eng?"
"Very clearly."
Talia looked over her shoulder, suddenly aware Spavo was watching.
"Go through, please, and pan around to the shelves or alcoves or whatever you find in those rooms.
What am I looking for?
Keep going. I'll know when I see it."
Spava murmured, "And with luck, so will I." She twisted round to meet his eyes.
"I saw what I thought was a white tree on Frilla's suit. Briggs says it's a building, and I believe her. But I knew I'd seen that form somewhere else, and recently. It was in the Bronner residence."
"A white tree?"
Spava asked.
"No."
Talia leaned closer to the console.
"Hold that angle, please, Prefect Boniface." "It's a candle holder,"
Boniface said. "There are others like it, now you mention it. I didn't pay much attention to them before."
"Nor did I," Talia said. "I just put it down to the Bronner's taste in minimalist decor."
"And now?"
Boniface asked. Talia glanced back at Spava.
"Well, do you agree that there's a similarity?"
"It could be coincidence."
"It's more than that. You saw what was on Frilla's suit, a skeletal white tree, with a narrow trunk and branches holding some sort of weird white fruit. And now this, a skeletal white candelabra, with the candle holders like white spheres. It's a symbolic connection between two of the wildfire cases, the first we've seen."
"Maybe there's something in it,"
Spava allowed. Talia turned back to the console.
"Thank you, Prefect Boniface. Can you bag and tag those candelabra, please, and have them brought back to Panoply under an evidential docket?"
"You really think there's a connection?"
Spava said, when she had closed the call.
"Maybe it's nothing, but now I'm more determined than ever to have a look at the building inside the rim."
Suited up, they returned inside and met Brig in the reception area, her beak-nosed helmet now clamped down over her neck ring.
She waved them through a short warren of rooms and corridors until they reached one of the functioning spoke elevators. Brig made sure they were properly orientated, feet hooked into stirrups on what would become the floor as they travelled out to the rim from the weightless hub. It only took a minute. The elevator shot up the spoke, then broke through into the enclosed volume of the rim, descending, or so it then felt, through a vertical glass tube that stretched from the rim ceiling to its floor level. Thalia couldn't see much beyond the glass, only the vague, dreamlike impression of a darkened landscape, stretching and curving away. "Tell me what you know about the building," Thalia said on the suit-to-suit channel.
"Just that it's there," Brig said. "There are 8 partitions around the rim, and we were all assigned different jobs. I didn't ever work in Chamber 2, and that suited me fine. I don't believe in ghosts or bad spirits, but they still couldn't have paid me enough to spend long in that place."
"What was so bad about it?" Sparva asked.
"I don't suppose either of you remember what it was like before the 80. There wasn't much you couldn't do in the Glitter Band or down on Yellowstone. But then things changed. They tightened the laws, made lots of things illegal. Most places buckled under and accepted the new restrictions, but not all of them."
"Like this one?" Thalia asked.
"Trick was to stay just the right side of the new regulations, while bending every rule as far as it would go. All those things you couldn't do elsewhere, those services you couldn't buy, those experiments no one could run, they could still do them here if they paid well enough. It was all still legal, just. What went on here? You can't call them crimes, exactly, but they were against something. And things like that leave a stain on a place, a sort of spiritual blemish, like a bad atmosphere."
"Are you superstitious, Prefect?"
"Not at all," Thalia said.
"Then you haven't been around long enough," Briggs said.
The elevator arrived. They stepped out, climbed a short pedestrian ramp, then stood in the barely lit silence of the chamber. A few service lights glimmered from the ceiling, just enough to throw a dismal twilight pall over the surroundings. Thalia allowed her eyes to adjust to what light was available through her visor, slowly taking in the size and shape of the interior space. Bulkhead walls blocked her view in either direction around the rim's curvature, each about 0.5 kilometer away.
"Wasn't it wasteful to dump all the air that was in this place?"
she asked, noting the hard vacuum reading on her visor display.
"We didn't," Brig said. "This is Chamber 1. Behind us, that way, is Chamber 8. That's the one we're using as a reservoir, holding all the air and water we pumped out of the other 7. Easier to work in vacuum, especially if you have to replace parts of the outer skin."
"Does anyone still live here, apart from the reclamation crew?" Thalia asked.
"No, this place was abandoned 30 years ago. Left to rot, more or less. Biome collapse, trophic cascades, oxygen balance gone haywire, the whole works. No one had deep enough pockets to fix it after the main sponsors cleared out."
Brig was going ahead, leading them along a raised path, heading in the direction of the end wall separating Chambers 1 and 2.
"Economy's different now. Makes more sense to clean out and reinvest in a place like this, rather than build a new habitat from scratch. Not complaining. Works for me. And there's no one left here, apart from us and a handful of robots we haven't flushed out yet."
Thalia bristled, but kept her voice level.
"Robots?"
"Oh, just some old monitoring servitors. Still convinced they've got a job to do. Get under our feet now and then, but they're harmless enough. You don't have a problem with robots, do you?"
"Why would I?"
"Just asking," Brig said.
The path was raised on stilts, meandering across a kind of glassy, solidified mudflat that was cracked like old varnish. The ground level was about 3 meters under the close-fitting planks of the path. Spiking out of the mudflat were the brittle remains of old vegetation, shock-frozen reeds and bulrushes. The mudflat had very clearly been a lake bed, with buildings dotted around it on their own islands.
"What happened to the people who lived here?"
Thalia asked.
"There weren't as many as you'd think," Brig said. "Just a few thousand, across the whole habitat."
"That's hardly anything for a place this large,"
Sparva said.
"I'd have expected a few 100,000, 500,000, easily."
This was never a place where people came to live. Ordinary folk, if you can call them that, visited, made use of the services, and left.
Brig pointed ahead to where a spider-legged thing had scuttled up onto the walkway.
That's one of the robots. It's detected us and noted our presence. That's all they do. If I had a gun, I'd shoot it.
Talia regarded the robot. Previous encounters had given her a profound mistrust of such machines, but the spider-legged thing presented no obvious threat. It really was just an eye on a set of spindly, many-jointed legs, its unblinking lens staring back at her with a dumb, reptile vigilance.
"Tell me more about these services," she said.
"People think everything's possible somewhere in the glitter band," Briggs said. "Really, though, that's never been the case. There have always been limits, safeguards, usually for good reason."
"You're preaching to the choir," Sparva said.
"Then you know what I mean. People don't like being told what they can and can't do."
"Do you think Terzet Frilla might have been one of those ordinary folk?" Talia asked. "Someone who came here, made use of whatever it is they do here, and then came back because of unfinished business."
"Like I said, Terzet wasn't all that keen to talk about themselves. I'll ask again, Prefect. The same thing the others wanted to know. Why are you so damned interested in a single death on a reclamation project?"
"Would you rather we didn't care?" Sparva asked.
"It's not that. But we all know there aren't many of you to go around. So when you do take an interest, there's a good reason for it. Usually to do with something bigger than a single death."
"One unexplained death on our watch is one too many," Sparva said.
"I wish I believed that, Prefect," Briggs said, "and I wish you believed it, too."
Ahead of them was another of the spindle, single-eyed robots. It watched for a few seconds, then scuttled into darkness. Talia felt a shiver of unease run down her spine, and told herself to snap out of it.
"Unidentified vehicle," said a female mendicant's voice, calm but with an undercurrent of authority. "You are on a fast vector for our docking pole. You are, of course, welcome to visit our facility. But we would strongly encourage you to decelerate, disclose your identity, and clarify the purpose of your approach."
"Sister," he answered, "it's Tom Drivers. Normally I come by civilian shuttle, but I happen to have panoply business nearby. I apologize for the fast approach and the lack of transponder signal, but I imagine you know why I'm here. Would you happen to have a docking slot available for me?"
The answer was a little while coming, as if the mendicant on traffic duty needed to speak to someone in a senior position before giving her assent.
"Yes, of course, Prefect Dreyfus. You should find a number of open docking slots, make use of whichever one suits, and there'll be a welcoming party waiting for you on the other side of the lock."
"Thank you, sister."
Hospice Idlewild was a makeshift sort of place, but scrupulously well-tended. It went back quite a way. The mendicants had made it by joining together a pair of diamond hulls discarded by ultras, fusing the cone-shaped forms at their wide end, and lining the interior with rubble mined from Marco's eye. The habitat's nearest pointed end, bristling with docking ports and servicing structures, loomed large. There were many ships parked there, some much larger than the cutter, but Dreyfus had no trouble finding somewhere to dock. He released himself from the seat, but for a moment he did not leave the little ship. Dread and hope battled within him. It was still possible to go back. He could feign some emergency call from Panoply, and no one would be any the wiser. Except, of course, Dreyfus himself. Dreyfus left the ship. He pulled himself through the docking connector using the built-in rungs. Two mendicants, a young man and an older woman, were waiting for him. Both wore the long-hemmed black vestments of their order, with wimples over their heads and metal snowflakes chained around their necks. The young man had an earnest, eager look. Dreyfus had never seen him before, but he nodded his recognition at the woman.
"Sister Catherine, it's good to see you. I'm sorry it's been a little while since my last visit, but these last 3 months."
Catherine had a long, grave face, and a down-curved mouth which did not lend itself to jocularity.
More like 9 months, Tom, unless my recollection is flawed.
It can't be that long, he said, before trailing off, certain as he could be that Sister Catherine had no reason to exaggerate.
You've been busy. These are difficult times.
If there was forgiveness in that answer, it was sparing of warmth.
You won't have met Brother Sebastian. He only joined us half a year ago, and the mendicant you spoke to from your ship was also unacquainted with you.
Sister Catherine beckoned him forward.
Come, we'll say no more of it. I know these visits weigh heavily on you.
The mendicant led him along a series of laddered shafts, gradually moving further away from the habitat's central axis. Eventually there was enough gravity to make walking practical. Sister Catherine threw open a door and daylight blasted through. They stepped into the green-carpeted core of the world, a line of artificial sunlight spearing it from end to end. Paths ambled the way in various directions, some of them sloping quite steeply.
"Watch your footing," Sister Catherine warned. "There was a mud washout here a few weeks ago, and we still haven't shored up all the paths. The stones tend to end up further down the valley, and it's back-breaking work, bringing them up again."
"There are never enough of you," Dreyfus said. "We're always open to volunteers," Sister Catherine said. She had a walking stick, jabbing it into the descending ground as if impaling a snake.
"One line of work's enough for me, sister."
"We're busier than usual," Brother Sebastian said, speaking for the first time. "A ship came in, a high number of sleepers, needing our care. They'd had some sort of problem with their shields. We'll help those we're able to, of course. Many will be able to go on to a normal life in the Glitterband. But not all who remain with us in Hospice Idlewild are able to offer much practical support for the community."
"Valerie has always been a blessing to us," Sister Catherine said, as if Brother Sebastian's words might have been misconstrued. "She tends the flowers with great care and affection."
"It takes more than flower beds to keep a world running," Dreyfus said.
"We know, Tom," Sister Catherine said, "but we do what we can."
There were no trams or monorails in Hospice Idlewild, merely the paths, few of which were large enough to qualify as roads. They spidered off in all directions, up and over the ceiling of the world, meandering through swaths of forest, linking the clearings where the mendicants had established white-walled hamlets, clinics, convalescent lodges, and schools for those in their care. Occasionally here were rock faces and waterfalls, some of them upside down, but none so large or impressive enough to stir any sense of the sublime. The overall effect was more one of a world-enclosing miniature garden, with every aspect selected for the maximum impression of harmony and tranquility. Nothing about the habitat had any sort of soothing influence on Dreyfus. The personal ties were too raw for that. The path leveled out and they walked past an open-air clinic, where black-clad mendicants were working with a dozen or so white-gowned patients, helping them with walking exercises and simple games to improve hand-to-eye coordination.
"The recent arrivals?" Dreyfus asked.
"No, far too soon for them," Brother Sebastian said, lowering his voice as they moved into earshot. "These came into our care just before I joined. Mild to severe revival amnesia, with some locomotor deficits, but they are responding well to the therapies, and I expect most will leave us within the month."
"Incomers or economic frozen?"
"Another ship," Sister Catherine said. "In from Fand. Nothing wrong with it this time. Just the usual statistical sample of bad luck cases. Put 20,000 sleepers on a starship, and a few dozen will come out of the holds with their memories gone. Or worse."
Dreyfus watched a female mendicant offer some spoken encouragement to a young woman with a heart-shaped face and dark eyes. They were tossing a black ball to and fro. The young woman smiled something back, perhaps no more than a single word of acknowledgement, but enough to put a twist in his guts.
"It's kind of you to do what you can for them."
"They would find a similar quality of care elsewhere in the system," Sister Catherine said. "Perhaps a little better than what we can offer, But what we do without expectation of payment. No one is in debt to us, or indentured into our service. That is not always the case beyond the hospice.
I don't doubt you.
Besides, there is a sort of insurance in what we do. Our methods may be simple, but they are robust. If some terrible thing were to happen to the rest of the Glitter Band, the ships would not stop coming. That would take decades. Sister Catherine paused to open a small white picket gate that led from one part of the clinic to another. Who would care for the sick and needy then?
Do you think terrible times are coming? Dreyfus asked.
She stepped through the gate and jabbed down her walking stick.
I think it is best to be prepared, wouldn't you agree?
Beyond the picket fence was a short path, bordered by stunted trees, and beyond that was a U-shaped enclosure of low white buildings with thick walls and rough-edged windows and doors. The buildings were arranged around a patch of dry, sun-dappled ground, set with chairs and tables. A number of mendicants were sitting at these tables, working with gowned patients. Sister Catherine turned back to Dreyfus, nodding once. He knew then that Valerie had to be among these patients.
Over there, Tom, at the table in the corner.
Sister Catherine moved her stick from one hand to the other and settled a forgiving touch onto Dreyfus's shoulder.
I have some work to attend to. Sebastian will take you to your wife.
Slowly, Talia's eyes had adjusted to the ambient light, picking out the sheer face of the wall as it loomed over them. The cliff-sized bulkhead was semicircular, flat across the base, and rounded at the top where it met the inner ceiling of the wheel. There were iris-like pressure doors in the wall at various heights, but Brig had informed them that there was a service lock at floor level, giving access to the next chamber via a short tunnel.
You'll see what they're looking for easily enough. I'll be just fine waiting here.
Are those robots likely to cause us any trouble?
Talia asked.
They can trip you up if they don't get out of the way fast enough. But beyond that, you really don't like robots, do you?
She's got her reasons,
Sparva said. It had been a while since they had last seen one of the spindly robots, so perhaps they would be alone for now, their presence registered and noted, but otherwise of no further concern.
I'll level with you, Brig. Talia said, "We're involved in a larger investigation, and Frilla's death seems to be a part of it. Knowing that, is there anything else you can share with us about what went on in this place?"
"Everything I know is second-hand," Briggs said, "what I've picked up since we started clearing it out."
"Still useful to me?"
"This whole wheel was just a shell. They rented it out, one partition at a time. There were buildings in each partition, sometimes dozens, and they were owned by different people and run like independent kingdoms, little habitats in their own right. Most of the time, what went on inside was kept secret, unless you were a client, and to be a client you needed money."
"And from what you say, Frilla may have been rich enough," Sparva said.
"Just my guess."
"Tell us what you know of the individual services provided by the buildings,"
Talia said.
"You name it, from what I gathered. Each of those buildings specialized in something different. Dangerous games, dangerous experiments, any sort of surgery or modification you wanted. Quick and dirty procedures for people in a rush, and not too many questions asked."
"And the white building?"
Talia asked with a shiver of insight.
"Did they go in for neural modifications there?"
"Why neural?"
Brig asked.
"I'm afraid I can't."
Talia started.
"I have a question,"
Sparva said, cutting across her answer.
"Should those reeds be moving?"
He was pointing across the mudflat at a nearby clump of vacuum-frozen reeds. Talia stared at them, wondering what the fuss was about. The reeds were as still and stiff as they had always been, until they twitched, buckling back and forth as if being stroked by invisible fingers.
"They shouldn't be doing that,"
Brig said.
"Someone obviously hasn't told them,"
Sparva answered slowly.
"Air could make them move," Talia said, "but there isn't any air in here."
"You told us there was no air, Brig."
Brig said quietly, "There shouldn't be."
The reeds were still,
then moving, then still again. But the intervals of stillness were growing shorter, the movement more emphatic. The three of them had stopped, bewitched by the moving forms. Nothing could have felt more out of place than those brittle, twitching reeds. It was as if one element in an otherwise static picture had come to life, a horrible intrusion of animation, where none belonged.
"It was a hard vacuum when we came in," Sparva said.
"I know. I checked as a matter of routine. Now my suit's picking up a small partial pressure and it's rising."
"Mine too,"
Talia said, lowering her gaze to the visor display and cursing herself for not picking up on it sooner. "Could some air have come with us in the elevator?"
"Not enough for this,"
Brig answered. "It must be leaking back into this chamber from number 8.
"Is that meant to happen?"
Talia asked.
"Shit like this used to happen all the time.
Lately, though."
"Whatever the explanation," Sparva said, "it's getting stronger."
Something buzzed across the suit-to-suit channel they were using. The buzz became a voice, halfway through a sentence.
"Out of there now, Brig! Bulkhead 1 is opening. Repeat, Bulkhead 1 is opening."
"Slider," Brig said, "we copy. We can see the airflow. One of the irises must have opened. Can you override and shut it from the herb?" Brig sounded concerned, but not unduly alarmed. The reclamation crews must have become used to things like this going wrong as the ancient and baroque environmental control systems flickered in and out of life. An annoyance, and bad timing, but not an immediate cause for panic. But Slater Virak said,
"This isn't the usual screw-up, Brig. The equalization doors are opening in sequence, top to bottom. We saw red lights on the status monitors a couple of minutes ago, but none of the usual tricks are working this time."
"Shit, Virak, you gotta be kidding me."
"I'm not, and I strongly suggest you get out of Chamber 1. We're nearly at 2. We can be through the connecting tunnel in a few minutes."
"Too risky. If the overspill floods the tunnel, you'll be in even bigger trouble. Can you get back to the spoke?"
The reeds were buckling over now, snapping one after the other like glass whiskers. Loose debris was starting to tumble across the mudflat, small clumps to begin with, but gaining in size as the force of the draft increased. Talia could feel it for herself, a soft pressure against one side of her suit, and through the suit's audio amplification, a faint but rising scream of inrushing air.
"No chance, Virak. It's going to hit hurricane force long before we'd get back to the spoke."
"Then find shelter, high ground if possible."
Larger, heavier pieces of debris were being picked up by the air now. Not just frozen foliage, but shards of rubble and building material left over from the clearance process. Talia pointed to a junction in the raised walkway, one of its forks leading to the shell of a building rising from a nearby island.
"That should do, shouldn't it? Those walls look pretty strong."
They quickened their pace, Talia and Sparva breaking into a jog. But Brig's suit was heavier and clumsier, and it soon became clear she would struggle to match their speed.
"Go ahead,"
she urged, waving them onward.
"I'm slower, but I'm also tougher. I'll see you at those walls."
"No,"
Talia said. "We don't leave you. I demanded your presence. That makes you my responsibility."
"Best not argue," Sparva said.
They walked as quickly as Brig was able, the force of the wind gathering all the while. They were having to stop, relying more and more on their suit's locomotive assist just to maintain their footing. Debris shot by on both sides, larger and larger items now being uprooted and carried away by the rising gale. Door-sized flakes of building material tumbled overhead, borne on the thickening air. Something donged against Talia's helmet, nearly knocking her over.
"Why high ground? What did he mean by that?"
"Just move," Brig urged.
They were at the junction in the path, a Y-shaped fork leading to two different islands. Debris was raining down almost continually now, hammering against the path, larger and smaller pieces hitting their suits. Instinct had Talia wanting to reach for her whiphound clipped to the outside of the suit, but there was nothing it could do for her under these circumstances.
"Something new happened," Sparva said, slowing for a moment. "Can you feel it? The ground's rumbling under us. It wasn't rumbling a minute ago."
"Water," Talia guessed.
900,000 cubic liters of water,
Brig answered, in a sort of daze. Not far shy of a million tons. If the doors open in sequence, like Virak said, we'll get the air first, then the water.
All right, Spava said, with a sort of fatalistic calm. There's a lot of water on its way. That island's still the only high ground anywhere near us.
Here it comes, Brig said, twisting around. It raced towards them across the mudflat, furred with a heavy coating of debris, a mindless stampede of water.
Chapter 7 Dreyfus watched as Sister Catherine ambled away, then allowed the other mendicant to lead him to his wife. Distracted, trying to think of anything but the reason for this meeting, he found his gaze drifting to the pattern of light on the sun-dappled ground, the restless play of the individual specks of brightness.
"Brother Georgi," Sebastian said in a low, respectful tone, "I've brought Mr. Dreyfus to see Valerie."
Georgi, the mendicant sitting opposite Valerie, had obviously been forewarned of this development.
"Thank you, Sebastian. Tom, it is very good to see you again."
"It's been too long," Dreyfus said. Georgi waved aside this self-criticism. "Many would sooner forget that they ever had friends or relatives in our care. In fact, they have been known to have their memories adjusted for precisely that reason." Georgi was facing him, Valerie still with her back to Dreyfus. They had been engaged in some childlike game, with symbolic cards spread across the table. A rooster, a house, a constellation of yellow stars, drawn five-pointed. Valerie had lost language. She had lost not only the ability to read, but also the mechanisms of verbal expression and understanding. Speech to her was a meaningless, upsetting babble. For years, the patient mendicants of Hospice Idlewild had been trying to rebuild the neural pathways of linguistic function. For years, they had been getting almost nowhere. But his voice must have drawn some glimmer of recognition in her, for she turned to meet him, her expression open and friendly, but also seemingly focused on something beyond him.
"It's me,"
he said, scuffing out a vacant chair and lowering himself into it. They were at the thickest point of the habitat, and gravity was at its strongest, the chair's wooden ligaments creaking under his frame.
"You look well, my love."
He risked reaching out a hand, extending it slowly until he was able to touch the side of her face. He was cautious, because she had flinched from that hand before, and on one occasion struck it forcefully out of her way, as if deflecting a blow. This time, at least, she permitted the contact, even if there was something uncomprehending in her eyes.
"Has Sister Catherine told you very much about me, Georgi?" Dreyfus asked,
slowly withdrawing his touch, but allowing his other hand to touch Valerie's fingers, where her hand lay amid the symbol cards.
"Only that your wife suffered an accident, and that you visit her more often than many. I know of your profession, of course, but that is no business of mine."
Dreyfus was silent for a few moments, looking into his wife's eyes and trying to find some recognition in them, some sense that she remembered what they had once been.
"When Valerie was first taken ill, I didn't have the strength to deal with what had happened to her. In fact, I did exactly what you just mentioned. I had my memories adjusted."
"I understand that the circumstances were difficult."
Dreyfus smiled at the understatement, buried in that remark, some tension inside him giving way.
"I was responsible for her condition, you see. I took a course of action that brought Valerie to this state."
"Did you intend to hurt your wife?"
Georgi asked plainly.
"No,"
Dreyfus answered.
"Then I suppose you acted to protect the needs of others."
Dreyfus nodded slowly. "That doesn't excuse it."
"Sister Catherine told me you were placed in an impossible situation."
Georgi moved some of the symbol cards around, flipping a few of them over to show different pictures.
"That's all. If you were such a bad man, why would you come to us now?"
"If she has to bear this, then so should I."
"It isn't hopeless, Tom."
Georgi selected a symbol card and pushed it into Valerie's fingers.
"Say it,"
he encouraged, touching a finger to his own lips. It was a rabbit. Valerie moved her mouth and began to shape, awkwardly and tentatively,
something like the opening vowel sound for the Canadian form of the word.
Good, Dreyfus said.
He squeezed her fingers.
Very good, Valerie.
But the word died incomplete. Valerie swallowed, weariness and puzzlement showing in her face, as if she could not understand why she was being put through this vexing task. If you lose language, Dreyfus wondered, do you lose also any comprehension of the point of it? But he forced himself to smile again.
These are early days, Georgi said.
I can see how much you care. She couldn't hope to be in better hands.
Our methods may seem slow, but we have patience. That's our greatest asset. And Valerie is content here, I can tell you. She is very good with the flower beds. She has an eye for colors and harmony. I'll show you how they're developing if you have time.
I'd like that. The three of them went to the flower beds, walking along the narrow paths laid out between the beds. Valerie walked slowly but steadily, a hand always ready to catch herself if she fell. Around them there was a great deal of patient gardening going on. A male mendicant was kneeling with a man, showing him how to plant new bulbs. Another mendicant was watching as a young patient worked along one of the borders with a bright yellow watering can. There were red flowers, painted onto the side of the can, daubed on in an exuberant, childlike fashion. The simple innocence of the flowers softened something in Dreyfus, and he smiled, this time without putting any conscious effort into the gesture. Then he caught Valerie's eye and saw that she was smiling as well, either at the happy colours of the watering can or at Dreyfus's reaction.
"Show me what you've done," he said,
beckoning at the beds in case the intent of his words was lost. Valerie gave him a tour of her work. She said almost nothing, either because she had no means of voicing her thoughts or was ashamed at her own limitations of expression. But her gestures were precise. The lesson she was giving him, in the arrangement of colours and patterns, one that she clearly expected him to heed, and so he did, nodding and stating aloud the things he believed she meant him to hear. Once or twice a frown of confusion or irritation troubled her features, but for the most part she did not seem displeased. Afterwards they returned to the outdoor tables and drank tea. They held hands again. Dreyfus attempted to coax Valerie into calling out the things on the cards, but she refused him, not unkindly, with a firm but serene shake of her head. He understood. The lessons, the hard path she was following, were a private trial best kept between herself and the mendicants. Georgi came back to the table after helping with some minor carpentry, a saw still in his hand.
You see that she's making progress, Tom. You don't need to imagine it.
I don't.
But she needs encouragement, a sense that there's a world outside these walls, waiting to welcome her back into it. We can't do much about that. Some of us barely remember what it's like beyond Idlewild. But you can give her that goal, Tom. You're a busy man, and we recognize that. But try to find time.
I need to head back, Dreyfus said, cutting the other man off, and instantly regretting the abrupt tone he heard in his own voice.
Of course.
Georgi rose from the table and bid Valerie to do likewise.
We'll accompany you to the path, if you're going back that way. I understand you have pressing business, but can we count on you to come back to the hospice before long?
Yes, Dreyfus affirmed. Yes, very shortly. I won't let it go as long next time. The three of them walked slowly out of the sun-dappled area, back towards the picket fence that Sister Catherine had opened. As they approached the open-air clinic, though, Dreyfus sensed there had been a shift in the mood. Voices were raised, one in particular. There was no anger as such, but a heightened exchange was clearly taking place. Puzzled, he began to pick up his pace, even at the expense of leaving Georgi and Valerie to follow behind. Sister Catherine came around a corner, planting her stick determinedly.
"Oh, I'm too late," she said,
her face sagging with instant regret.
"I'm sorry, Tom. I was hoping to encourage you to spend a little more time in the language compound."
She gave the other mendicant a beseeching look.
"Georgi, why don't you take Tom and Valerie back to see the flower beds, and take the high path via the three falls?"
Dreyfus prickled.
sensing that all of a sudden he was an unwelcome presence. "Is there something I shouldn't see, sister?"
"We trust each other, don't we?"
she asked.
"I thought so."
"Then take my advice and go with Georgi. Nothing bad will come of it."
Dreyfus prickled again, but not because of Sister Catherine's words, which he was sure were sincerely meant, but because of that raised voice, from just out of sight. It was impossible. It cut against all logic. But he knew beyond any doubt to whom it belonged.
"He's here, isn't he?"
Dreyfus said slowly, barely believing his own words.
"Devon Garland's here."
Talia watched the encroaching water with a peculiar detachment, fascinated and horrified in the same moment. It was a broad, shallow, fast wave. They were not going to be swept under between one breath and the next, but it was travelling quickly, and Talia saw no end to the water beyond the approaching front. If anything, it was bulging, more water piling up behind the leading wave, like a crowd of people trying to squeeze through a gap.
"This isn't good,"
she said, voicing a thought that she knew she should have kept private as soon as she spoke.
"We should brace,"
Sparva said, planting his hands on the walkway's railing and gripping it tightly. Talia and Brig followed his lead. The surge licked its way closer, seeming to pounce forward in the last moments. Talia took a final look down at the still, dry ground, 3 meters below the level of the planks on which they stood. Then the water arrived, still moving with a clearly defined front. It had seemed like a liquid thing until that moment, but as it surged under the walkway, its nature changed to something solid and dense, carrying a fearsome momentum of its own, more like a landslide or avalanche, sweeping a tumbling cargo of boulders and debris in its passage. The water rammed into the stilts supporting the walkway, jarring them to their foundations, and that angry, juddering vibration transmitted itself through to the planks and railings, threatening to shake them loose. Steadying herself, dizzy with the motion of the water, Talia looked down again. The 3 meter gap between the deck and the ground was half submerged, and the level was still rising. There was no hope of accurately measuring the rate of the rise, not with the surging chaos of waves and debris as the water forced its way between the stilts. Maybe a meter, a minute, she decided, which meant a minute and a half before the water was going to be flowing over the walkway rather than under it. It was enough time, she decided. All they had to do was get to the section of walkway that climbed up to meet the island, and then they would have meters of extra height, and still more if they reached the highest ground on the island. If that proved insufficient, she would still have bought time to explore further survival options. Her situational training emphasized immediate practicalities, what it took to remain alive for the next minute, and the minute after that, rather than concerning herself with 10 minutes or an hour from now. It was hard-won pragmatism, distilled from hundreds of real-world scenarios faced by earlier generations of prefects. The lesson was that it worked, most of the time. So be it. She held her breath, slowly released it. Water continued to pass under them, a black conveyor belt dotted with industrial rubbish, lapping higher now, but no faster than her earlier guess. They kept moving. The walkway continued to vibrate, shaking violently every few seconds as some substantial items struck it. Every now and then the force came close to knocking them off their feet. There were sheets of material, lightweight construction blocks, cargo hoppers and pallets, some of them as large as a panoply cutter. Talia fixed all her attention on the island, and the hoped-for sanctuary of the elevated ground. It would be enough, she told herself, and they ought to be on to the sloping section within half a minute.
"How deep was this water?"
she asked Brig. "Before you pumped it out, I mean."
"Waist deep. You could stand in it here, anyway. But there were deeper lakes in some of the other partitions, and all that water was pumped into Chamber 8.
"Can we expect all of it to drain out?"
"No, I don't think so. There are multiple locks in all the bulkhead walls at different heights from the floor. They can't all have opened."
"Why not?"
Sparva asked.
"Because there'd be a lot worse than this," Brig said.
Now the flood was a racing black carpet, licking just under the level of the deck, with surges occasionally racing over the planks. On top of that, the winds were still lashing,
still pelting the walkway, waters, and exposed areas of ground with an assortment of dirt, rubble, and building materials. The bombardment was increasing in severity. Presumably what had been a slow leak of air was now a raging downburst, as the connecting lock opened to its fullest extent. It would ease eventually. There had to be an equilibrium at some point, but they were obviously nowhere near that moment. Then, between one step and the next, the walkway jerked, tilting sharply. Sparva, always steadier on his feet, managed to stay upright, but Talia was sent sliding into the open gap between the deck and the railing. Brig grabbed at her flailing right arm, and then Talia managed to fumble for a grip of her own. Something large had rammed them underwater, knocking out one or more sets of stilts. Along its entire length, the walkway had developed a nauseating twist, and now meters of it were pitched below the level of the water. Awkwardly but steadily, the three of them made it back to a level section. By now the water was welling up through the gaps in the decking, and the bombardment of debris had become a continuous vibration. They carried on, Brig pushing her suit to the limit, Talia and Sparva doing all they could to assist, and then, in the last 100 meters, the walkway began to slope up out of the water, becoming a connecting ramp that took them up to the ground level of the gutted building and took them 3 or 4 meters above the still rising water. The wind might have been peaking. Talia's suit registered 2 atmospheres now, but the rate of increase had been slowing, and there seemed little chance of it climbing much higher. Even if it did, the suits could cope, and oxygen at least was not going to be in short supply.
"It looks as if the gale's easing off," Talia said, as they neared the top of the ramp. "We'll still look for shelter, but at least we don't have to worry about being hit from above."
"We were just in time,"
Brig said, pointing to the lower section where they had just been. The walkway was severed now, broken into several pieces. One of the sections was riding away on the tidal surge, completely detached from the stilts. Only now that she was on firm ground, or what counted as firm ground, did Talia give any thought to contacting Panoply.
"Prefect Aang," she said, "requesting emergency extraction?"
A thin, distant voice answered her.
"Panoply, Prefect Aang, what is the nature of your emergency?"
Talia swallowed, looking around. The water had enclosed the island completely by now, and was already well over the level of the walkways. Debris surged past like a vast flow of traffic, heading on urgent business.
"Prefect Bankal and I are in the outer rim of the Addison Lovelace Concordancy, along with a civilian witness. There's been a containment breach from the 8th partition, air and water re-entering vacuum. It could be deliberate sabotage. We're safe for the moment, but we expect the water level to continue rising. Reviewing your situation now, Aang, if it was deemed necessary to drill or blast through from space, could you tolerate a rapid decompression event?"
"Yes, we're suited. Whatever it takes. Send in weavers if you need to.
A heavy tactical squad has been tasked to your coordinates. They should be on station within 60 minutes. In the meantime, can you call in local assistance?"
She conferred with Brig for a few seconds, discussing options, before returning to the Panoply operative.
"No good, I'm afraid. They're not set up to deal with this sort of emergency, and they haven't got anything that could cut through the outer wall in much less than 13 hours. This is a skeleton crew of clean-up technicians, not a heavy technical squad. Even if they could send more workers to us from the hub, there isn't anything they'd be able to do in the time available to us."
She eyed the water level.
"Is there any way they can get to us sooner?" "Negative, Aang. They will be on an expedited burn as it is."
Talia accepted this without rancor.
"If that's the best you can do for us,
so be it. When they arrive, tell them to liaise with the reclamation team in the hub. They know this place better than we do. We've arrived at a partially demolished building. The wall should protect us if there's another air surge."
"Prefect," said Brig, touching Talia's arm.
"Wait a moment,"
Talia told Panoply, following Brig's direction of gaze. A second surge of water was approaching from the same direction as the first, moving across the already flooded areas like a steep kink in a carpet. For a second or two, Talia studied it with a kind of disembodied detachment, as if she were the only playing witness to a catastrophe involving some other hapless individual. If the first surge had easily swamped the 3-meter height of the walkway, then this second influx contained a lot more water, perhaps 3 or 4 times as much again.
The lower doors must have opened, Brig said.
So it would seem,
Talia said, but she fought to keep her voice steady and clear as she continued speaking to Panoply.
This is Eng again. I have an update on our situation. There's a lot more water coming our way.
How much is a lot more, Eng?
I don't know. Maybe 3 or 4 times the initial surge volume. I thought we'd be safe on this island, but it won't be enough. You'd better get that extraction squad speeded up.
Your urgency will be communicated, Eng, but they were already on an optimum crossing time. Nonetheless, I am sure that if there is anything that could be done to shave some time off that estimate, they'd do it.
Yes, I understand.
It's going to overwhelm the land, Brig said, staring with mesmerized fascination at the approaching water wall.
We'll have to ride it out, Sparva said. Find something that floats, something we can use as a raft.
When you find us a raft, tell me,
Talia said.
Would that do?
He asked, indicating an outjutting spur of land, which had trapped the section of the walkway.
All it needs to do is float. It should work for long enough for the swell to subside. We just need to get to it in time.
She heard the heaviness in Brig's voice when she replied. Not optimism, just a stone-cold certainty that they had no other options.
He's right. If it doesn't sink, we'll stand a chance. Do you have a plan, Eng?
Panoply asked. She was about to say that they had nothing resembling a plan, just an act of last-ditch desperation, but she bit back on those words and said,
We have a contingency. We still need that extraction squad as quickly as possible.
Understood.
Good. If you hear from me again, our contingency worked.
They moved quickly, negotiating a vague, barely defined path that led them down to the spur. Only the final sloping part of the walkway now stood above the water level, and that was slowly being submerged. Talia guessed the initial surge had already reached 5 meters above the former ground level. By the time the secondary surge arrived, they would be under 15 to 20 meters of water. Talia thought of the hundreds of thousands of tons of water building up behind that step change. She had faced killer robots once, and that had been bad enough. But robots usually had a will and a purpose, or were at the very least operating at the behest of some other intelligence. There was always the faint possibility of negotiating with something that had a mind. The section of walkway Sparva had identified was only the size of a large door. It bobbed on the rising swell, only snagged at one corner by the spur. Talia would have preferred something bigger, given the three of them, but they were lucky to have any raft at all. The planked decking was intact, and it still had parts of its railings on either side, which would give them all something to hold on to.
"Get aboard!" Sparva said. "Water's rising so quickly it'll lift free any moment!"
They climbed the board one at a time, the raft tilting under their weight, but maintaining buoyancy. Talia squatted down onto her haunches, knees raised before her, and hooked her elbows into what remained of the railing, Sparva and Big doing likewise. The black surge was almost on them.
"Here it comes,"
Talia said, tightening her grip as best she could. Her fear had been that the rising wall would break before it hit them, but the one mercy was that mass of debris riding the water made it travel sluggishly. The angle of water tilted ever steeper, and with a jerk the raft broke loose from the island. The tilt increased. Talia strained to hold on, the railing feeling looser than she would have liked. She felt a sickening sense of elevation, butterflies playing in her belly. All around them was a jostling, crashing confusion of waterborne debris, some of it much larger than their little raft. Huge empty cargo pallets loomed over them, their glossy sides like sheer, weather-polished cliff faces. The swell carried them higher, lofting them with an almost insouciant disregard for mass and physics and the intrinsic frailty of small humanoid organisms. Things crunched against the raft from all sides, ramming from below, raining down from above. Water crashed across the deck with iron force. The swell crested, and then dipped with sickening speed before cresting again. Then another dip, a terrible, jaw-like trough opening up in the water before them, and Talia did the only thing she could think of, which was to close her eyes, hold tighter than ever, and trust that the universe was not quite done with her today. The upswells and downswells continued for what seemed like hours, but was probably only a minute or two, and then, imperceptibly at first,
The chaotic motion began to die away, as the water that had flooded into the chamber found its natural level. The entire floor was completely submerged, with no visible trace of any of the walkways. The islands were all underwater as well, with only the upper parts of the buildings pushing out of the swell. The water gradually calmed. Talia surveyed her companions, gratified that they were both still on the raft. They seemed uninjured. If they felt the way she did, they would have their share of bruises and torn muscles. But given the stakes, they had come through the flooding remarkably unscathed. She drew a breath and realized she had not been breathing for some time.
"That has to be all of it," Talia said. "Right, Brig?"
"I think so,"
Brig said.
"It shouldn't get any worse. I think this must be all the water that was in the 8th chamber. We were lucky."
"I wouldn't call it lucky. I'd say we were pretty damned unlucky to have this happen at all. It's sabotage, I'm sure of it. Those robots must have been monitoring us, acting as eyes and ears. Someone detected Panoply interest in this place and decided to snuff us out."
"If they were hoping it would make us less interested," Sparva said.
"I'm not sure they thought that through."
"No," Talia agreed. "It's odd. Clumsy at the very least. And all that'll happen now is that we'll double down with our investigation.
Are you all right, Brig?"
"Yes. Bashed around a bit, but my suit's holding."
"So is mine.
Sparva?" "I won't look any prettier by the end of the day, but I'm all right."
"You did well. If we hadn't got to the raft..."
"Wait,"
Sparva said, interrupting her with an edge in his voice that she did not care for.
"What is it?"
she asked.
"We've started drifting.
We were floating around on the swell just now. But now we're moving again, heading towards the other bulkhead."
"That isn't possible,"
Talia said. "It's just a piece of walkway. It doesn't have an engine."
"No,"
Brig said, "but he's right. I can track our movement against the ceiling. We've definitely picked up a drift, and it's getting faster. There's only one explanation. The water's on the move again."
"But you said it must have emptied out of the other chamber."
"Equalized, at least. Now there's only one thing that could make the water move again." Brig looked past the prefects, in the direction the raft was moving.
"It's the lock into partition too. It must have opened on its own. The flood's draining straight through."
"Is that good or bad for us?"
Talia asked.
"The water level will go down once it's spread into the other chamber, but I'm worried about how it's going to get from here to there. Those connecting doors aren't large, and with the amount of water trying to force its way through, and with us going along for the ride..."
"What she means is," Sparva said, "it's going to get bumpy."
"Maybe it's just the lower door,"
Talia said.
"If that's the case, then the flow's mostly going to be under us. We just have to sit it out, wait for the levels to settle down again."
"No,"
Brig answered. "With the way this current's picking up speed, they must have opened one of the higher doors, at or just below the existing water level."
"You think it's someone trying to help us?"
Talia asked, conscious now that their motion was gaining, the water on either side moving with them, but only because they were caught in its rush.
"If they are, this isn't how I'd do it,"
Brig said. A roar was growing, carried to Talia's suit by the air that had not long returned to the chamber. It was a thunderous, waterfall roar. The swell they were riding was beginning to tilt in the direction of movement, while on either side, steepening embankments of water were starting to flank the flow on which they were being carried. The bulkhead wall was coming nearer by the second. At the point where the water met it, Talia saw a dark, circular aperture, the bottleneck they were shortly going to be squeezed through. The raft would fit, but there was no telling what sort of turbulence it would encounter as it made the passage. She dared not think what lay beyond. Let there be some sort of continuing flow, however treacherous, rather than a waterfall. She made herself hang on even tighter than before, pushing body and will to their limits. But just as she identified the connecting door as their most immediate difficulty, Sparva nodded urgently to one side.
"Brace yourselves!"
he called. It was one of the cargo pods, shouldering nearer as the water flow began to constrict on the approach to the lock. Another was looming in on the other side, with more beyond. They looked as huge as houses now, and just as sturdy. The debris had been moving almost sedately until then, caught in the deceptive stillness of the flow,
but now objects were beginning to clang and jostle each other, fighting for space like frightened animals. The pod knocked them, then came rebounding back, seeming to gain momentum between strikes. Talia tensed.